structure. We handle the value investing for Ridgeworth Investments. The structure has been very beneficial to us in essence that everything that is non-investment related is offloaded to our partners at Ridgeworth Investments. And what do I mean by that? Everything such as sales and marketing, compliance, HR, real estate, technology, all those tasks that could be a distraction to an investment manager, those are offloaded to our colleagues at Ridgeworth Investments. We have our own in-house IT person that handles any type of issues, i.e. the dreaded blue screen of death that we may get on a daily basis. We have somebody that's on site to handle and help with that. As you can see, this information is a tad bit dated as we had to try to get it to you before the deadline, but the AUM as at the end of the first quarter is $9.6 billion. In small cap, we had $3.1 billion. It's probably a little higher than that as the market continues to melt up. But I want to make a point to note that the small cap strategy, since your inclusion in terms of our partnership, we've closed the strategy. That was April 20th of 2012. So we're no longer taking any new assets within this strategy. You're certainly able to contribute and add or subtract at your leisure, but we're no longer adding new assets because we believe we're at a sufficient level to continue to maintain the level of integrity that we've had in the past. And it's the third time we've closed a strategy in our history. So barring any type of cataclysmic type event, we don't foresee that changing here in the near future.
So you're comfortable with the amount that you have under management now?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How do you figure out how much capacity you have?
Well, that was a determination made by the PM and our CIO, Mills Riddick, who's also the large cap portfolio manager. It was based upon liquidity and the market conditions. So at that point in time, it was closed, not at this specific number, 3.1. Obviously, the market's seen a little bit of appreciation since that point. So the number was around maybe 2.6, 2.7 billion when we initially closed it back in April of 2012. Page 4 gets into the investment team. An update here, there's been no changes since we've initiated our partnership. Brett Barner is still the lead portfolio manager on the strategy and has been doing that for quite a long period of time. We have 7 analysts that support all 3 PMs. They cover the entire market cap spectrum, large to small, small to large. We believe we get great synergies from the information flow across the market cap spectrum. And then myself and Sarah, everybody's housed in Orlando, Florida, so there's no sharing resources amongst our other sister boutiques, if you will, with Ridgeworth. So everybody that works at the boutique is housed in Orlando, Florida. And what I do want to make mention is I do want to offer the invite to the members of the board. If you're traveling or willing to come travel to Orlando, Florida, we're willing to entertain you, if you will, kick the tires, so to speak, meet the portfolio manager, meet the analysts, walk through the investment process, get a first-hand look in terms of what goes on. So I want to have an open invitation to any members of the board. If you're there vacationing or if you're there just passing through, we want to open that up for you. Behind tab 2, page 5, and I apologize, I should have mentioned this at the beginning, the page numbers are in the upper right-hand corner. We try to hide them as best we can from everybody. But the investment process is what you see here in front in terms of a very broad sense, but the little moniker we like to use is 3 to get in, 1 to get out. What do I mean by that is that we need all 3 of these investment tenants to be present in a security in order that security be included. 1 gets violated, the security is removed. So first and foremost, dividend. We require a dividend. We don't have a specific yield or benchmark requirement in terms of the dividend. We just require that the company pay a dividend. And we like the characteristics of dividends. They give you a show of the earnings power of a company. They give you a source of total return, and they also lower volatility. And it's the information we get from dividends that we glean most of our information. As companies initiate those dividends or continue to pay them, it's the signal that they send to you is what we deem as most important. The second tenet, valuation. We're looking for low expectation stocks. And how do we define that? We define that as companies trading the lower end of their historical valuation range with a specific valuation metric that the market values it on. So we're not applying a blanket, if you will, price to book, PE, price to sales. So we're using a specific metric that the market values each security on. And then lastly, where the portfolio manager and team spends the vast majority of their time is looking at the fundamentals. What is going to repair that valuation disparity that we just talked about? Well, it can be numerous. The most vivid ones that everybody probably gravitates to are, you know, we have a corporate action, we have a joint venture, we have a new product, new process. Those are the type of things that we're looking at management change in terms of the fundamentals. But what I want to stress is that all three of these tenants must come together for security to be included, not just one of the three or two of the three, but all three, and the security then is up for debate from the portfolio manager and analyst for inclusion in the portfolio. Page six is just a waterfall diagram of our investment process. It's not meant to be the exact in terms of the numbers, but just give you a diagram. We construct the portfolio. The number of names currently in the portfolio is 86, and we're looking at each name we put in. We're setting price and valuation targets for these securities. So it's a very dynamic process in nature. It's not static. Page seven, just again, very briefly talking about the sell discipline, equally as important as the buy. As I mentioned, the little moniker of three to get in, one to get out. So if one of those investment tenets are violated, the securities are removed. The easiest one is the dividend. If the dividend goes away, we will, within small caps, obviously it's a little bit of an issue in terms of liquidity, not so much for our mid and large cap brethren, but for small caps, we will look to eliminate that security or remove it as quickly as we can if the dividend's eliminated. The second one, in terms of relative value, as I mentioned, in terms of as we get to our established price targets, the risk reward for that security truncates, so we're looking always to create the best risk reward profile we can. So we will look then to swap out into different securities. And then lastly, which drives the portfolio manager's nuts, if you will, is that when we get the fundamentals wrong, we don't get them right 100% of the time, but when they do deteriorate or they're wrong, or if the structural nature weakens, or let's say that there's a direction by the company and if you will, that they change their tune, so to speak, we're not afraid to sell stocks and again move to the next best risk reward opportunity we can in our investable universe. So page eight gets behind tab three. Page eight gets into your investment portfolio that we'll get here in a second. But let me just stop and ask if there's any specific questions. I know it's a very broad type of overview of our investment process, but I wanted to sort of reinitiate and reengage your thoughts on that. So if there's any questions, I'll entertain those real quick. If not, we'll just move forward. Okay. Page eight gets into the portfolio as of June. The total market value as of the end of June was $184,562,513.53. As you can see here in terms of cash, we're fully invested. Cash is transactional nature for us. We're not looking to manage our cash. So we try to keep our cash balances below the 5% level. So as you can see here, we're well within that threshold. But certainly there could be times when cash could be higher than that, depending upon inflows and outflows. But for the most part, that should be below the 5% value that we stated. Just to give you a little flavor in terms of where we've come from just from the end of the quarter, the market value as of end of the 22nd that I wrote down was $197,092,652.91. So just from the end of the quarter, we've seen a fair amount of appreciation in the marketplace since the end of June 30th. So the markets, if you will, continue to melt up. Page 9 and page 10 are just account activity summaries from a quarterly perspective and annual, and they all tie back toward that $184 million number that we talked about just a few moments ago. Again, gains and losses, interest and dividends, a net withdrawal from an annual basis that in terms of redistribution was $50 million. Don't know the exact date, but that's part of the annual overview. Page 11 is the investment performance that we'll jump right into.
Steve?
And then, yes, sir.
Just before you leave that,
absolutely.
The quarter and annual, when I looked at it, why do you show withdrawals? I mean, obviously it has the impact of why there's a different value in the fund, but mm-hmm. typically you're showing what your earnings are in the fund.
Well, the earnings are below that specific figure. We do include the interest dividends, realized and unrealized gains and losses. It's just tying back to the respective end market value number. And that's from an annual perspective.
And remember, we rebalance twice a year too. And so it could be that if equities were up, we pulled money back to rebalance to other assets.
Now, those aren't our withdrawals, are they?
Yes, they are.
Oh, they are. They are.
No, we didn't. We certainly didn't take any of your money out.
All right. Now I understand.
No, absolutely. No, that's on your direction, not ours.
Okay.
But thank you for that. You had me going there for a second. I'm like, well, I certainly don't have any of those assets. Page 11 gets to the investment performance. So we initiated our relationship toward the end of 2011, sometime around the November time frame. So our full year was 2012. On a gross basis, we returned about a little over 19%, and the benchmark returned about a little over 18%. So we were able to have a decent return in 2012. As you recall, 2012 was a little bit of volatility in terms of what was going on from a macro perspective. We're bottom-up stock pickers. So when we have a lot of the macro noise, if you will, driving the marketplace, it's a little bit difficult for us to differentiate ourselves with what, when the market's driven by macro elements. Moving to 2013, we finished off 2012, hopefully on a fair note in terms of your opinion. 2013, first quarter, continued what was a very good fourth quarter for the strategy. It continued in the first quarter, but with volatility. As you recall, the first quarter, we saw a little bit of a defensive posturing in terms of the marketplace. Utilities, healthcare, staples were leading the marketplace. Our stock selection in the first quarter actually drove the outperformance for the first quarter of 2013. However, if you moved into the second quarter, we saw a tad bit of volatility that's been within the market for the last few years, and that impacted us on the negative. So if you look from the picture of the 90-day window on page 11, you see that the strategy returned 31 basis points versus the benchmark of 247. There was no change from our positioning from the first quarter into the second quarter. It was mostly market dynamics. What drove the underperformance, if you will, was our overweighting or stock selection with industrials, energy, and healthcare. Those are the same names we owned in the first quarter of 2013. So it was, if you will, it was a role reversal in terms of some of those names that worked in the first quarter that didn't work in the second quarter. And we've seen some of that reversal here again into the third quarter in the beginning of July. So from a year-to-date perspective, the bulk of the underperformance, if you will, from a year-to-date view, trailing by 190 basis points, is predominantly from our underperformance in the second quarter of 2013. Names that we continue to own, names that we'll dive into into the following page. And then from an inception-to-date number of November 2011, again, the vast majority of that underperformance lies within the second quarter that just occurred. Just to give you an update with regards to where we are today, the third quarter I mentioned in terms of the delta between the market values from 197 million through 722 through the end of June of 184. What I can give you is in terms of the fund, which prices daily, the fund is up 731 and the benchmark is up 799. So we're trailing a little bit from a fund perspective. But things so far have been going well. Earnings season for a few of the names that just reported the other day have been a positive impact to the strategy. And I'll get into that on the next page. But let me just stop and see if there's any questions I can answer on page 11. Page 12 gets into a representation of your portfolio, some of the sector concentration, top 10 holdings, characteristics. We'll just start left and move our way right. In terms of the sector concentration, you can clearly see that we're not benchmark huggers, if you will. We know where our implied bets are versus the benchmark. We just went through a Russell reconstitution at the end of June 30th. Some indices actually increased and decreased. That changes the representation here, but we did not, for the most part, change any of our security holdings. The vast majority of the delta lies in pretty much a couple sectors. We're vastly underweight financials, and there are a few reasons that I'll get into there. We're overweight industrials. I'll jump into that. And then lastly, we're vastly underweight utilities. Now, financials, where the bulk of our underweight lies is predominantly within the REIT segment of financials and also the banks. From our investment process, if you recall what I mentioned, the three tenets, the dividend, the valuation, the fundamentals, we need all three of those to come together. REITs and banks clearly have the yield requirement that we would require. But from a valuation or fundamental standpoint, we're really not finding a lot of opportunity from our investment process, the opportunity set within the financials. Where we do see opportunities, as you can clearly see, is our overweight within industrials. Now, industrials, you probably more than likely have the your normal inclination to think of like heavy machinery, but I think industrials is more of a hodgepodge, if you will. There's transportation, there's business services, there's railroads, there's airports, there's your electrical HVAC, if you will. So it's a vast hodgepodge of companies that fall within industrial space. And that's where we're finding all those three tenets that I mentioned in terms of our investment process, and they're coming through industrials. They're not coming through the financials or utilities. Utilities we think are expensive in terms of a valuation perspective. They don't fit our investment process, so we're not going to try to fit that square peg in a round hole. That's why we're overweight areas in consumer and areas within industrials, and slightly overweight energy and slightly overweight consumer staples, but very specific stories, if you will, there. Let me stop, see if I can dive in into any of these specific sectors. Yes, sir.
It seems, I appreciate the comments on financials. I was going to ask about that. It seems somewhat counterintuitive because, I mean, if you get the Goldman Sachs and the B of A's and the JP Morgan's off the table and you're working in smaller cap stuff, there's a lot of interest these days in regional banks. And they appear to be kind of a lot of potential there. And yet you are significantly underweighted on financials. And so is that our local and regional banks something you do not look at and you don't care about maybe missing that boat?
No, sir. I think it's quite the opposite. I think when our financials analyst is looking at these in addition with the portfolio manager, they're not seeing those specific metrics or tenets of our investment process inherent within, say, REITs, which is from a valuation perspective, they're very lofty in our opinion there from a REIT perspective. Although we are selective. If we find something to add, we will. And we've added a few, but nothing from a major percent standpoint. If you dissect the financials weighting, a little over 13% of the financials benchmark weighting in the Russell 2000 value is within REITs. So we're vastly underweight that from the perspective. We're really not finding a lot of those names that meet our valuation parameter within the tenants. Now, within the banking segment, you make a good point. You exclude the Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Citigroup, Bank of America, some of those multi-global national type names. In our opinion, we're still vastly overbanked from a small cap perspective.
Really?
We think that there's way too many banks in the United States at this point in time. And we really haven't seen any type of consolidation in a vast majority. We've seen few, and the few that we've seen, in our opinion, those banks have paid a very high multiple for those acquisitions. So if you have company Bank A and Company Bank B combined Company Bank C, well, one of those two banks is going to lose their respective jobs. And there's really no large incentive for one of those company banks A or B to make an acquisition that'll lead to the demise of their respective jobs.
How quickly can you typically rotate out of a sector? I mean, is it done on the fly or is it done on a quarterly basis? Semi-annual basis, what?
When you refer to transitioning out of one sector to another, it's easy enough just putting the order into the system to make that order occur. But it's a little bit unique for small caps, if you will, is that the liquidity aspect in small isn't as large as you would imagine within mid and large. You can easily put an order in to buy 200,000 shares of Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and execute that on a daily basis, no problem. But when you get into small caps and you're looking at Hancock Holdings in New Orleans, it's quite a different feat to try to get into that name versus some of those others. So it's not impossible. We factor in the price movement of a security in and out of it from a small cap perspective in our risk reward, because we know if we're going to build a position in a name and we like it, we're going to build a fairly decent sized position, we could potentially move that stock up as we get in and out and down as we move out. So we try to factor that into our risk reward calculation when we're looking at a name for inclusion into the portfolio.
Okay, thank you.
Let me just add a little bit in terms of why we're underweight utilities. I mentioned it. We think that the valuation parameters are vastly extreme for utilities. Also, in this low interest rate environment, when utilities have a guaranteed ROE and the delta between what an ROE at a public utility commission and what the Treasury is fairly large. Well, in our opinion, that could lead to a lot of ROE review by public utility commission boards and put that at risk. And then that, in turn, risks their earnings at utilities. So that's why we're underweight utilities. Industrials, where we're overweight. If you then transition to the top 10, you could make the inference that we should have a lot of our top 10 names in industrials, and we do. So if you go through the top 10, A. O. Smith, I don't know if you're very familiar with what they do, but I'm sure if most of us either have a house or an apartment, you probably have one of their products or one of their peer products in your house. They do water heaters. And there's the average age of water heaters is getting up there. So about 10 years, you're starting to see the life end of your water heater. And for the most part, if your water heater goes out, it's not a purchase that you're going to delay. If you get home, like my wife will tell me, if there's no hot water in the house, I'm driving to Home Depot or Lowe's, I'm getting a new water heater that evening. And that's similar to what we're seeing in terms of dynamics. The average age of water heaters in the U.S. is somewhere around 12 or 13 years. Not that I want to infer that anybody in this room has an old water heater, but at some point, there could be the change in terms of getting a new water heater, and that's a benefit to A.O. Smith, in addition to what you may not realize is I also have a very growing business in China. And as the Chinese are increasing their middle class, the need and want for hot water is growing. And they also have water filtration, so that's part of their business as well. That's doing, and they just reported earnings the other day and actually beat and raised guidance. So that's a very good positive. Progressive Waste Solutions, probably don't know what they are. They're a garbage hauler in North America, one of the top three large garbage haulers in America. They're doing very well. One of my favorite names that I always like to look around when I come into offices is Interface. You may not know who they are in terms by name, but what they do is carpet tiles. And carpet tiles is a growing business in the sense that as they're growing out into other mediums, the hospitality industry is one where they're actually seeing a tremendous amount of growth. So, for example, they're growing their business in Las Vegas. Las Vegas, we know, has a multitude of rooms. The last thing that a hotel in Las Vegas wants to do is have a hotel be out of commission. Because what does that mean? That's loss of revenue for them. What Interface's carpet tiles will do is allow them to basically replace carpet tiles that are damaged or dirty and get that room turned around quicker than if it was a wall-to-wall carpet type situation. Because what does that mean? Well, we have to take all this furniture out. Then we have to rip the carpet out. Then we have to put the carpet back in. That could take a whole day depending upon the schematics of the room or where they're getting their carpet. Carpet tiles basically is just removing those areas that are impacted, switching them out, and getting that room turned around right back into renting or selling for that evening. And they're moving into schools where hospitals, so they've got a great amount of opportunities to grow their business, and we think it's a very good security to be owning in the portfolio. And then lastly, Lennox. HVAC company, if you will, a traditional, maybe industrial. They're seeing good metrics for their HVAC business, and they just reported a good quarter. So let me then get to the last bucket up top in terms of the portfolio characteristics. A couple questions that I think probably will jump out. Dividend yield, we have a dividend requirement. Natural inclination would be your dividend yield versus the benchmark is maybe slightly less or right on top of it. Shouldn't it be higher since you have a dividend focus? Well, twofold. One is that we don't require a specific yield threshold or metric. We just require a dividend because of the characteristics of dividends. But two, we're underweight some of the vast yielding type stocks in the benchmark. That would be utilities and REITs. So one, we don't require a yield threshold, but two, we're underweight those specific sectors that tend to have a fair amount of yield to them. That's why our yield maybe not be as quite as robust as maybe what you would expect. And then price to book, that being above the benchmark, well, the financial sector, again, making up about almost 40% of the benchmark, where we're vastly underweight is where they use price to book as a valuation parameter. Well, being underweight that, the price to book for some of our other companies may be higher, but they're not valued on that specific metric, say a la industrials. That would give us a characteristic higher versus the benchmark when you're looking at it on a comparison basis. Let me stop there. Behind that is a description of the top 10 names and then the respective holdings for your portfolio. I want to make sure that I offer enough time for any questions and make sure that I'm not over my allotted time slot.
Is Progressive Waste Solutions more of a regional player? You said they were in the top three, but I've always understood that to be Waste Management, Republic Waste Connections.
So those are the two very large cap type securities. Progressive Waste has operations in Canada, and they recently bought some garbage haulers, if you will, down in the southeast to try to grow their presence. So predominantly, they're not to the scale that you would call Republic or Waste Management, but they're the number three player in the waste management arena.
Ahead of Waste Connections?
Yes.
Do they have any landfill exposure?
I'm not sure exactly how much they have, but they do have landfill exposure, yes. Because that's where they would take the scraps or whatever they're hauling to the respective landfills.
And is this company on a growth cycle? Most of the players in that industry, and the only reason I'm asking this is because I work in it, have been through a series of reorganizations mm-hmm. that are essentially cost slashings every quarter to try to make numbers. In other words, the headcount reductions are staggering in that industry. There's been no growth because the economy has been slow. So I'm curious as to what Progressive is doing that's countercyclical.
Well, first of all, as I mentioned, in terms of our investment process, where we're looking for low expectation stocks. So as the security became unloved by some of the specific elements that you're talking about, construction and type of hauling has been taken a beating. That means expectations for that name and that industry have come down, and in our opinion, that's when we would have taken a position within that security. In addition to that, they made acquisition that I just mentioned in the U.S. that also impacted the view of the company, which gave us the opportunity to enter into a position in the name. And as they worked through the acquisition and bringing that into their overall operations and the improvement in construction, we think that's where expectations will then reinvigorate themselves. But we take 18 to 36 month time horizon, so we're not looking at it on a one quarter type basis. We're taking a fairly long term view of the company, and we believe as they bring in the acquisition into the company, and then as metrics for construction and hauling improves, we think the company's got a chance to benefit from that, and expectations rise, and then hopefully we'll be selling it to our colleagues outside the door, and they'll be buying and putting it in their portfolio.
Great, thanks.
Is Cash America with one of those payday loans?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Regulatory concerns about that, because a lot of states are trying to muscle them down a bit because of their usury rates.
Absolutely. It is always a concern. The news flow on that can be quite volatile. But they're the largest payday lender in the system, if you will. You don't want regulation to be so onerous that they get out of the business, because then that brings in, for lack of a better term, CD-type lending that I don't think no one wants to involve themselves with. Banks may not want to deal with the credit issues in terms of some of these payday lenders that they deal with. Yeah. Being the biggest player, we believe they can take share from mom-and-pop locations of payday lending, and also continue to abide by the regulatory requirements as they come up. But we haven't seen them, in terms of our opinion, the regulations be so as onerous to negatively impact business. What's actually impacted the business recently, excuse me, if you will, is a fall in gold prices, because we've seen a ton of individuals come in and pawn their gold for money, since gold prices were at a huge premium. As gold prices sold off, the association with Cash America, that's what's been one of the negatives to the stock here recently. But we still like the name in terms of its position in the industry.
And looking at that stock, you've actually lost money on it.
Yes, we have. Yeah, and it coincides from a year-to-date perspective with the drop-off in gold.
And so how long do you hold it before you decide it's time to get rid of it? Or how do you guys make the decisions?
Well, certainly we're not looking at the gold exposure as one of the key criteria for that. We think that, again, as I mentioned in terms of Cash America, having a leadership role in the payday lending space, being able to take share from mom and pop lenders, grow that, being able to fend off the regulatory type requirements that are going to be present. We don't think they're going away. We think they're going to have to work with them. But being the biggest player in that space, we think that they have the ability to do that versus some of their local competitors that may have one or two, three type locations. We think the regulatory issues will allow them.
How do you guys decide when to get out? Well, of any stock.
Well, one, if it reaches a preset determined price target that we have. So if once we get to a preset target that the analysts and the PMs have set, we'll exit the security. So the risk reward metrics have truncated. So we'll then look to another. Then secondarily, the fundamentals. If those fundamentals deteriorate or they're not working in the fashion that we expected them to work, we will exit the security.
And who makes the decision? And the reason I'm asking is this. It looks like you're the portfolio liaison, basically.
Yes, sir.
You're not the guy making the selections.
No.
I like to try to learn how you guys make the selections. You came by yourself. You didn't bring anybody that I can talk to
sure.
find out what they use. So that's what I'm trying to find out.
Absolutely. And so let me sort of go backwards. The reason why Brett Barner didn't come is that we want him to be at his desk, if you will, managing your assets versus being on the road and not being in front of the news flow in terms of what can transpire on a day-in, day-out basis. So that's first and foremost. But the second thing is that the PM, if you will, and the analysts are scouring their respective universe on a daily basis for the three investment tenets that I talked about. So it's easy, one, to screen out stocks that pay a dividend. Check. Second one is screening for companies that are trading the lower end of their historical valuation range. So that would be the second. Once we get that pool of stocks, then the analysts are working to discover those improving fundamental situations that I talked about. Once they uncover those, rank them on a risk-reward basis, then they will in turn discuss that with the PM. It's the discussion between the analyst and the PM in that respective sector whether or not that security gets into portfolio. The ultimate trigger puller in terms of your question is Brett. So he will determine whether or not that's the security he wants in the portfolio based upon his overall view of constructing the best risk-reward profile he can. So we'll set a price target for that security based upon the fundamentals that analyst is ascribing to that portfolio manager on that specific security. So the few reasons why we would get out: we reach a price target, the fundamentals deteriorate, or we have a better option that can replace a specific security that we have in the portfolio. Those are the three type of reasons why we would get out of a stock.
Right, part of this is to learn the person who's in charge of our money.
Yes, sir.
And I would venture to guess that when you guys came around and wanted our money, that he showed up.
Yes, sir.
And it would be nice to be able to talk to the person once in a while to make sure that we're still on the same page.
Absolutely. Duly noted.
Just a format issue. If you look at page 14, I'm just trying to figure out.
I probably know what you're going to ask, but go ahead.
Okay. Well, we save a lot of time. Just answer the question. What was the answer?
If you're looking at the way that we're grouped here on the page.
Yeah, it makes no sense whatsoever.
The bottom of the above securities is the sector. So if you start underneath cash equivalents, Arcos Dorados all the way down to Thor's consumer discretionary. Then below that is consumer staples. Below that is energy. Below that is financials. Below that is healthcare. Below that is industrial. So it's not probably what you expect.
Not what I would call crystal clear. You know, generally the heading. If I look at the energy heading and I see Banco, insurance.
I'm thinking this is
not making sense to me.
Not a bank.
Same question.
Not a bank. So maybe somebody comes up with a different format. It'd be a little easier for me to read.
Understood. I'm sorry. I apologize. Anybody else have a question?
Sure.
Smaller cap stocks, by definition, have fewer analysts following them and less information.
Correct.
So how does a boutique firm like yours have enough firepower to follow all these small companies?
Well, Brett's been following small caps for over 25 plus years. from that perspective. So he's got a lot of experience following these names. And then our analysts are constantly scouring the universe. Now, to your point, there's a lot of small cap names. How do we narrow that universe? We narrow that universe by requiring that dividend requirement. So we're not looking for every small cap stock. We're looking for small cap stocks that pay a dividend. And that's the first cut for our investable universe. And then we go down to that valuation parameter that I just talked about. Companies trading the lower end of their historical valuation range. So from our perspective, point well taken, there's a lot of small cap companies. We try to narrow it by using that dividend as a first cut, and also then our market cut is 50 million to a cap of 3 billion. We will not initiate in a company that's above $3 billion. So that's how we are narrowing the universe in terms of small cap, from 50 million to 3 billion at the top end that pay a dividend is our first cut, and then that's where we then whittle it down to a more manageable type universe. Yes, sir. They come to our offices. We go travel to see companies. A point that I think I want to stress that I didn't is that being in Orlando, Florida, is a huge benefit to us in the investment management business. And the reason why I say that is that we have the number one or number two convention destination in the country. Between Las Vegas or ourselves, we get the most of the major conventions coming to Orlando, Florida. So 20 minutes down the road at the Orange County Convention Center, we're getting a vast majority of the largest conventions coming, whether it be healthcare, industrial, home and gardening, aerospace, you name it, it's coming to Orlando, Florida. And that allows our analysts, if you will, to kick the tires with executives, buyers, suppliers, when those type of conferences are occurring, and it's 20 minutes down the road. And that I think is a valuable piece of knowledge in terms of when we're allowed to just go down the road and kick the tires of these companies that we're looking at on a day-in, day-out basis.
Steve, is trading range 52 weeks or some other period, and your bottom end, is it quartile, bottom quartile or bottom half? What?
In terms of your first question, the
52-week, is it the 52-week trading range, or is it a longer range?
For when we're looking at the
bottom of the lower part of the trading range, I think is pretty much how you've described it.
Sure.
What is that trading range?
Well, it all depends upon the history of the company. We'll look at the entire history of the company, but let's say a company has 20 years of trading history, but the first 10 years the company was doing one thing but morphed and transitioned into another type of company the second decade of its life. So to look at the first 10 years of its life, which have no bearing in terms of what it's doing now, we don't think would be appropriate.
So the trading range is unique to each company then?
It could be, yes.
It's not 52 week.
Correct.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get
yes,
to.
Yes, right. Correct.
So
correct.
You make a decision on what an appropriate time frame is to look at.
Correct.
All right.
Yes, sir.
And then what is the bottom?
The lower third of its trading range.
Steve, maybe a couple minute wrap up and back to Disney World.
Certainly. I first like to thank everybody on the board for your attention and your questions. I do appreciate that. We do appreciate your partnership. We look forward to meeting with you in the future. I will certainly pass along your comments to the portfolio manager with regards to his participation at these meetings in the future. But if there's any questions that we can provide you going forward, our contact information here is on the front page. I certainly want to echo the invitation of coming to Orlando. I know it's on the other side of the country, if you will, but if you're traveling there on leisure, we certainly would love to entertain you and introduce you to our office and our analysts if you have the opportunity. So thank you once again for the opportunity. We do appreciate your partnership and look forward to working with you in the future.
Thanks.
Thank you,
Steve.
Thank you.